Your true crime podcast keeps listeners on the edge of their seats. But here's the real mystery. Why isn't it making more money? Odyssey Creator Lab is here to solve that. We host your show for free. No fees, no catch. You focus on the suspense while our sales team brings in advertisers and revenue. Stop leaving money on the table. Apply now at creators.odyssey.com and turn your passion for true crime into real revenue.
From the meters of Sissy Strut, did you say somebody fired a box of bubble gum out on the field? Is that what they said?
Yeah, Jose Contreras last night apparently said something about the plate umpire's mama during the game between the Cardinals and the Pirates. He got ejected, and his tirade included going back to the dugout and throwing a box of bubble gum onto the field.
There should be some kind of federal law against heaving a box of bubble gum at somebody, don't you think? Can you imagine the carnage that could result?
It could be a weapon of mass destruction. You get it stuck on your shoes, your clothes, could be a disaster.
A weapon of mass destruction. Maybe more like a weapon of mass bubbles. I don't know. Either way, man, I used to love chewing bubblegum as a kid. You?
Still love it.
Yeah,
it's good stuff.
I got jaw troubles and all that mess. Anyway, we'll take a break. We come back. We'll talk about President Trump and deploying police all over the country or the military all over the country. Can he, should he, et cetera, et cetera. You can text me your thoughts at 504-260-1870. Tommy Tucker, back in the flash, WWL. I'm going to tell you what, I don't know who you worship or if you worship, but you should thank whomever for the hurricane season that we've had thus far. And considering we're approaching the statistical peak on September 10th, that we're pretty well clear for the next 7 to 10 days. Not only that, but the humidity is down, and I could feel it in my house. I don't know what that says about the insulation of my home or not, but I could feel how the air conditioner was at 70 instead of the usual 68, and it felt as cold to me or as cool to me as it normally did. Now, when I got out the shower this morning, I froze, just like when you're in Las Vegas or somewhere like that where the humidity is very low and you get out of a pool and you freeze immediately, even though it's 100 degrees. Right now, it's 76 degrees, going up to 90 today, but with lower humidity and dew points, it's not going to feel that bad. As normal, at least, with the humidity. It's still hot outside, but be aware of that. We'll talk about, when we take a second here, we'll talk about President Trump and, okay, we're having a little trouble getting the guests. We'll talk about President Trump and deploying the National Guard to different states for crime issues and whether or not they're real or not. I know he's quoting some stats that the local officials are saying are not true. So somebody I was talking to the other day, and I don't think they have Trump derangement syndrome or anything, but they did express a fear that they added a couple of things together. And President Trump was showing his hat collection to some foreign leaders. And one of them said, Trump 2020, what would it be, 2028? I guess it would be 2028. And he said, they're saying I should run again. I don't know, maybe I should. Of course, the Constitution prohibits that. And this person said, you know, what if President Trump is sending the military into all of these cities, starting with the nation's capital, and then before you know it, he or his administration controls the police forces or at least law enforcement in all of these cities, and all of this is being done with an eye toward him staying in office and not leaving. Then he made some comments yesterday about a dictator that has some eyebrows raising. Of course, President Trump just likes to raise eyebrows sometimes. David Schultz joins us now, professor of political science at Hamline University. How you doing, David?
I'm doing great. I hope you are, too.
I am. I was talking before the break about, you came on, and we got to take a break here in a second, about somebody, a friend of mine, and I don't think he has Trump delusion, what do they call it, Trump derangement syndrome?
Yes,
but,
correct.
But talking about how, wait a minute here, no, he's showing foreign leaders his hat collection and saying maybe I should run in 2028, I don't know. He's talking yesterday about dictatorship. He's now sending the National Guard into the nation's capital, first of all, and then major cities around the country, and people are wondering if this is a precursor to him not leaving office. And I don't know if that's Trump derangement syndrome or not. I can make a case for where maybe this person has a point, or no, that could never happen. We'll talk to you more when we come back about what the Constitution says and what what would happen if something like that should he should attempt something like that. It's 620, traffic now, WWL. All right, 6:23, back to David Schultz, quickly a professor of political science at Hamline University. Let me read some of the texts that are coming in here, David, just so you get in the sense of where the audience is. Do we actually believe any numbers or stats that the Democrat governors, mayors give? Well, okay. That's ridiculous, somebody else said. Somebody said Democrats are preaching dictator propaganda, although it was the president himself that used the word dictator. Tommy, where have you been? We're all warning against this last year. If you listen to Trump's latest press conference from the Oval, you are witnessing the mind of an authoritarian dictator. This guy is beyond unhinged. Ask him, why is our MAGA governor sending National Guard to where the dictator wants as versus needed locally in Shreveport and New Orleans? So anyway, that's a smattering of where the texters feel. Let's talk about what the Constitution says and what my friend was worried about with, wait a minute, there's like a frog in boiling water where it's the nation's capital and it's this city, then that city, then that city. Then before you know it, 2028 comes around and the National Guard is in control of all of the cities. Thoughts?
Okay, a few different observations here. One of them, I'm going to invoke our constitutional framers again. And as I always say to my students at the beginning of the semester when I teach, our framers started with one word, fear. Fear of abuse of power. And it doesn't matter whether it would be Biden, Obama, Trump, or whatever, or George Washington, go back to that point, is that we always have to start with a healthy skepticism about fear. And our Constitution is all about preventing abuses of power, and that we should never completely trust anybody, no matter who they are. And I just mention that because I think on both sides of the equation, Democrat versus Republican, we always need to have this healthy skepticism towards people in power, because what's the old line? Power corrupts, absolute power corrupts, absolutely. But having said that, first, the Constitution is clear, two terms that the president can serve. Two, we have a law in place called the Posse Comitatus Act from 1877 that bars the use of the military for law enforcement purposes. And with that, there's also a law that says that the president cannot invoke National Guard for domestic services or domestic policing. The request has to come from governors.
But it seems like that's what's happening now.
Exactly. If the fact pattern looks like that's why this is a lawsuit in California right now, Newsom versus Trump. It looks like he's in violation of federal law in terms of at least two federal laws in terms of my reading of the law and in terms of what's been historical reading of the law.
So what happens now? Because what recourse do governors have if the governor's saying, no, you're violating Posse Comitatus? And look, we went through that as we commemorate the 20th anniversary of Katrina about the National Guard taking over here instead of local policing. And the governor said, no, you can't do that. That's not legal. And at that time, and let me just say something else before you answer the question, and that is, we have never had these conversations with any president before, have we? And President Trump is partly to blame for these conversations going. I know people are easy to say Trump derangement syndrome, but he's the guy that's bringing a lot of this to the forefront.
Probably the only other time we might have had a conversation like this would have been during Reconstruction post-Civil War. But let us say in modern U.S. history, we've never had this kind of conversation before regarding presidents deploying National Guard or federal troops for law enforcement purposes. And so Trump has changed the debate in the equation. And that, again, and I know we're going to get a lot of texts on this one, that again raises all kinds of concerns about, no matter whether you think you love your president or hate him, you have to be worried about what? Potential abuses of power. And we have to start with that, because for a lot of people who might like Trump, they put Biden into office and they're going to be really upset about anything he does. And so both sides need to basically realize that there's a potential of abuse regardless of who the president is.
So what my friend was saying, is that beyond the scope of believability or possibility? Does he have Trump derangement syndrome?
Certainly, I'm not a doctor of psychiatry, so I can't make a comment on that. But in terms of—
Okay, let me ask you this. Is he worried needlessly?
No, he is not worried needlessly. I think we should always be afraid of anybody who who describes themselves as possibly a dictator or not wanting to leave office. That is enough of a reason to be concerned. People were very concerned when Franklin Roosevelt decided to run for a third term and were describing him as a dictator, et cetera, et cetera. So I think we always have to be concerned. And people who are raising that kind of skepticism and saying, what about the potential for abuse of power? That's healthy in a democracy.
Somebody texted in and said, we've never had so much crime out of hand in major cities before either. What the hell is wrong with trying to keep law and order? Well, I think the question is crime really up or down? Because the FBI statistics show that it's down, and it seems as though you could make a case that this is a manufactured crisis.
All the FBI reports do indicate, and these are very well established bipartisan numbers, FBI uniform crime reports, we are at a significantly low period in terms of crime, let us say in recent American history, and there's no indication at all that people are manufacturing numbers in order to try to claim that there's more crime than we want. In fact, politicians have every incentive at the local level to say there's less crime.
Should any American trust any politician, whether they're Democrat or Republican, 100% completely?
Never, and our framers would endorse that view.
I agree. Thank you, David. David Schultz, professor of political science and law at Hamline University. We'll take a break, come back, talk with a Katrina survivor who wrote it out at a hospital who actually works with us. Back in a flash right now, time for WWL First News. For that, we go to Ian Ozan.
Thank you, Joe. I'm Ian Ozan, WWL First News. Now back to Tommy Tucker on WWL AM FM and .com.
So we always hear about Jordan Fiegel, who produces from an unknown location. Well, not only is he not in an unknown location, but he's going to join us when we come back, because he's got an interesting story about riding out Katrina at Lindy Boggs Hospital, where he went after that and how he was rescued, which is really interesting as we continue our Katrina remembrance here. We were walking around just now, and you remember Christmas Vacation with Squirrel?
Yeah.
Yeah. Jordan's walking ahead of me, and I see on his back that he has one of these two-tone roaches. You know that?
Oh, no.
Yes, the maroon and tan that look like
tree roach.
That are not only reminiscent of a Studebaker from the 50s, but about the size of the car as well. So I said, Jordan, hang on a second. And I knock it off his back. And I can't tell you what Jordan said, but were the first two words of what he said.
Now, my question is, did you kill the insect?
Knocked it off. Well, first of all, had it been an armed roach, I would have wrestled Jordan to the ground and covered him with my body. That would have been the first thing.
Okay.
But the roach was unarmed. I was able to discern that in the moment. So I knocked the roach to the ground. And then I didn't just smash it. I tapped it. There's an art to killing these roaches, because if you smash it, you got a mess. I tapped it, stunned it, and then Jordan went and finished it off and dispatched the roach to hell where it belongs. Because, you know, these insect guys, what do you call them? Insectariums?
The exterminators.
No.
Oh, entomologists?
Yes, that was what we were like. Show me entomologists. There we go. Number one answer. They'll tell you a roach does absolutely no good, contributes nothing to anything. So dispatch him to hell whenever you can. We'll take a break, talk to Jordan Fiegel, get his story about the roach and also about Hurricane Katrina when we come back on WWL. 6:46, 14 till 7. Normally he's producing from an unknown location, but Jordan Fiegel, our executive producer, joins us now to tell us his Katrina story, because it is a fascinating one. How you doing, Jordan?
I'm good, Tommy. How you doing?
I'm well. Let me ask you a couple of questions. First of all, who do you think... That's from The Office. Why are you so mean to me? No, I'm just teasing. Tell me your story. How old were you when Katrina came and arrived?
16.
16, so what happened? It's August 20. When you want to start? August 27th, 28th, 29th?
I guess we can start the Saturday.
Okay. Be the 26th.
27th.
Don't start all this again. All right. Go ahead.
I think we figured it out. It was the 27th. No, I was. I used to work at Oakwood Mall and went to work like any other day. I was 16. I wasn't paying attention to forecasts and everything. And you know, shops slowly started closing down in Oakwood, and eventually they sent us home.
Uh-huh.
And eventually, I got sent home. My mom, you know, had worked at Lindy Boggs Hospital, Mercy Hospital, and she had hurricane duty, so she was going to go in whenever a storm came. And she brought me and my little sibling and our dog, Sierra. We go in Sunday afternoon, you know, unload the car, pack up, you know, get put in one of the little hospital rooms. Wasn't really thinking anything of it. Went to bed like normal Sunday night.
They had made arrangements, the hospital, for family members, and rooms were empty, so they said you can go sleep in it?
Yes, yep. And we were all in one room. Yeah, I slept on a little cot. It was just woke up, storm had passed by, you know, Monday morning, or mainly
passed. Any windows broken in the hospital or not?
Yes, some windows did. Not in our room, fortunately, but...
It was wild here, bro. I got to tell you, it was crazy.
I slept through it all.
Okay, and then what happens?
Didn't realize anything was wrong throughout Monday. We're just kind of going around. The backup power sources in the hospital were on the bottom floor, so they had to turn those off fairly
early. At what point did you realize the water was rising? Because Lindy Boggs is on Bienville, right by Lyuses,
yes,
pretty much?
Okay. Yep, right by Lyuses. Sometime Monday, we were out on the emergency room ramp just hanging out, and... while we were out there, we noticed the water slowly inching up, and it's like, well, that's not supposed to happen.
Right.
And we actually listened to WWL on the little radio I had, and that's when we found out, you know, that it hit the fan.
But that would have been Tuesday morning when you found out.
Well,
because the first notice was, I'm not trying to correct you, but was Dave Cohen, because I was here. Dave Cohen coming on the air on Tuesday morning at about 11, I think. Dave could tell us what time it was, saying that Walter Maestri from Jefferson Parish over at the Emergency Management Center told him that the levees had broken, water was filling in the city, the bowl was filling up, etc. But you had heard just stories of people in attics and all of that, and then when you saw the water rising, you presumed?
Yes.
Because downtown, we were walking around here by the Superdome thinking, and of course you were closer to the breach, on Bienville, we were thinking, man, we dodged a bullet. And when we come back, we're going to talk about how you got rescued and everything. So the water comes up. You're stranded at the hospital, basically?
Yes. We were just on like a little island in the hospital, basically.
With your dog?
Yes. Okay. And there were like, because a lot of the employees brought their pets, so there were 70-plus dogs, cats.
Wow.
Yep.
Okay. And then I know there was a nice reunion. We'll talk about that when we come back. Quick break, 650 traffic, WWL. All right, 6:55, 5 till 7, quickly back to Jordan Fiegel, who rode out the storm at Lindy Boggs Hospital. So the water's coming up. Cohen's on the air Tuesday morning, alerts the city that it's flooded. You saw it before that, though, because, and again, the communication was like the Flintstones, and honestly was. Tell me what happened from there.
Yeah, so Tuesday, we're just kind of hanging out in the dark, hot hospital.
No power.
No power since whenever they had to shut the generators off on Monday. Hundreds of people there, patients, employees, and family of the employee, the pets. And, you know, because everything's flooded, all the dogs are having to go to the bathroom in like a designated part of one of the roofs.
Oh, Lord.
Yeah.
So what happens then?
Like Tuesday, we're just hanging out. My mom worked in the lab. We actually had a little taco night that night with some of the, because all the employees like brought like extra food with them and everything. And so
not stuff from the lab.
No.
All right. So then what happens? And it's hot and it's miserable. You got patients. We'll talk to the doctor about that in a little bit. When do you leave the hospital?
Well, Wednesday. That comes around. We finally start getting word that, you know, there's a relief effort. They're going to be taking us out at some point on Wednesday. Obviously, they, you know, got the most critical patients that they could out first. It was probably around 5 o'clock Wednesday afternoon. By boat, yes. I want to say it was some Lake Charles firefighters. That's the memory I have.
But what's it like? You know, you go there in a car, you're leaving in a boat. Where do they take you? How long were you in a boat going down Bienville or wherever?
We went on a boat. They dropped us off to...
what was the route? Do you remember?
We went from Bienville. We eventually ended up at the cemetery at like the on Canal.
Yeah, because that was a high ground or what?
Yeah.
Okay.
And from before we went on boat, transferred to an airboat at one point. That dropped us off. That put us in another boat at the cemetery. That took us to the big mess at I-10 and Causeway.
How long were you there?
Probably about 5 hours.
Take a minute, if you can, and describe for people that have seen it but were not living through it. What was the situation on that Causeway gathering area, I guess?
Oh, it was bad. Like, it was just a giant mass of humanity.
Just chaos?
They passed out some, water and some MREs, but, you know, nobody had a place to go to the bathroom or anything like that. And it's,
were you frightened at any point?
Not really. I was 16. Right. I was stupid. I
mean, young, dumb. You didn't know.
Yeah. I didn't have to worry about, like a house or a job.
How
or
long were you there till they took you somewhere else?
I think it was around 11 p.m. They got buses for the hospital group, and they eventually got us out of there. We ended up in Lafayette. And when they took us out of the hospital, they only took people. So all the employees, including us, had to leave our pets behind in the hospital.
Yeah. Today's National Dog Day. Did you get the dog back?
We did get the dog back. And the guest we have coming up at 7 o'clock is a doctor who stayed behind to take care of patients and all the pets. And he kept all the pets alive. And they got him out probably 3-4 weeks later. I didn't know any of this. My mom was frantically tracking this all behind the scenes. But we reunited with our dog in Houston, flown on a private plane to us from some small Texas town. Now, we still don't know who paid for her to have surgery on her leg.
Now, you graduated from Jesuit, so I know you're mentally messed up. But seriously, did it leave any lasting effects on you? You were 16 at the time, and I mean, that had to be tough. Because I was a grown man when that happened.
I had nightmares for a while after it.
About specifically the Causeway thing?
Being in like a flooded city.
Wow. Thank you, Jordan. I appreciate the story. I really do. And you were reunited with the dog, and I bet the dog was happy to see y'all.
Oh, she was. She ran out of the plane right to us.
And you were happy to see her.
Yep.
All right, man. Thank you. We'll talk to who when we come back?
James Riopelle,
doctor. Who's a doctor and his wife who rode out the storm at Katrina. He's an anesthesiologist. We'll be back. WWL. 7:15 now, and it's Tuesday morning, August 26th. I do think Dave Cohen should be part of that symposium at the Le Petit Theater because he was the voice of all of this. Anyway, we'll talk now with Dr. James Riopelle, an anesthesiologist, and Jamie Manders, his wife. And as I understand it, Dr. Riopelle, your wife is on because you're a pretty humble guy, and she's got to tell your story. Am I accurate or not?
She tells it better, and she also was tremendously useful in getting me rescued from the hospital.
All right, let's talk about you first and being at the hospital. You're an anesthesiologist. You are on duty at the hospital when Katrina hits, and we're talking about Lindy Boggs Hospital, right?
Right, the old Mercy.
Right, and what happens here? What happens then? What, you go to work? You got a scheduled shift? Or you go in because of the hurricane?
No, I was on the hurricane duty. Actually, one of my colleagues told me she had an infant baby, and she was on duty, and she said, I'm just afraid to go to the hospital. So I told her, what better place to be with an infant baby than a hospital? She said, I'm just scared. Would you please take my call up, hurricane call? I said, okay. So we went in, and, the place was frantic with preparations. And, we were stuck up
Wait,
in a...
Wait, so if this lady doesn't have an infant, you're not even at the hospital, right?
Right.
Okay, go ahead.
I mean, she was, this baby was like under 6 months old.
Well, I'm not criticizing her. I'm just saying it's how fate dictates things sometimes. If not for that, you're not there. So go ahead.
I mean, the feeling that fate was, moving things around was an ever-present feeling the whole time.
I'll bet. So tell me what happens. The storm hits, and what are you doing? Are you?
So we're up with her, and they told everyone, because we know it's hard for people to come and work during a hurricane, bring your old parents with Alzheimer's disease, bring your animals. We will take care of them. Their parents can stay with you. You're good. And, of course, no one was expecting, the degree of destruction, the complete loss of electricity and power, the lack of ability to deliver even basic care to the patients, the problems with rescue, it's just turned into a nightmare.
At that point, the hospital is hot when the generators go off because of the water rising that were located in the basement, I guess, wherever they were. You're an anesthesiologist, but I guess you were just reverting to, I hate to say regular doctor, but a medical doctor and just administering care to the patients that were in the hospital?
I was an assistant nurse.
That's what you were. As an anesthesiologist, yeah. You were an assistant nurse, but it was all about patient comfort, right?
There were no opera. I mean, some people came to take vital signs. I mean, people were very stressed. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of all the patients who were there, a lot of patients there, a lot of ICU patients, a lot of nursing home patients, and the nurses were exhausted and stressed out, and there were no operations. So I looked around and said, you know, this is where I can help.
Talk about Hippocratic Oath. So they send a boat, and we're talking to Jordan Fiegel earlier, who was there. They send a boat. They rescue some people. But you stay behind, right?
When the people came to do the rescue, well, I think there was some people from the Shreveport Fire Department, they were given very clear orders that the triage system of removing people was, the doctors had tagged all the patients that were the sickest so they could get them out first. Mm-hmm. They said, no, we're not doing, you know, medical triage, we're doing military triage. Those who are the most able are the ones who will leave. The others will be left to die with no care, including, you know, like 20 patients or so, which I didn't even realize at first.
Wait, and really? They told you that? They told
yeah.
you that? That it was military triage, not medical, and they were only taking able-bodied people.
They left like 3 ICU patients and like 17 nursing home patients who were not able to get up and go down on the boat by themselves.
So there ain't no way you're getting on it. At that point, there's no way you're getting on that boat.
No.
Okay. So tell me what happens from there.
Three other people stayed with me for the patient's part. I mean, there was an old priest named Father Ignacio Rapolo, and he and I went around and gave, you know, water to patients, changed their diapers every day. And there was a respiratory therapist and a nursing supervisor, Cheryl Martin, and they went around and they took care of all the animals. And so we just, you know, worked very long days trying to do basic, I wouldn't even say it's nursing care, because there was no IV pump. We gave IV fluids or water, changed their diapers. That was about all we could do.
You're talking about the MASH days here, almost, with the IV, no pump, no nothing, just IV hanging on a rack and then administering it that
Everything
way, right?
Everything was primitive, and we're doing it by flashlight a lot of the time.
In what kind of heat?
Oh, well, I'm sure it was more than 100 degrees.
Because those windows didn't open, did they?
Well, some of them were smashed in by the storm.
Oh.
There were three people in the ICU who were left. Two of them were liver transplant. One went awaiting liver transplantation. One who had a liver transplant on a ventilator. Their family refused to leave. You know, I had tremendous admiration for them because they were sitting in a hospital. They knew nothing about hospital care. All of a sudden, they're there with their dying relative, and everybody leaves.
And
they were like, what?
I'm only begun to talk to you, and I've got tremendous admiration for you already. Let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back. We're talking to a doctor who wrote out Katrina at what was then Lindy Boggs Hospital on Bienville. More when we come back. Dr. James Riopel and his wife. 721 traffic now, WWL. Quickly back to Dr. James Riopel, who is joining us in between seeing patients or outside of asking him to stay the entire hour. Doctor, when it comes to you're staying behind with the patients, it's just brutally hot. You're trying to treat them. Plus, you're trying to take care of the pets, right?
Right. I mean, Jody Patterson and Cheryl Martin, and they took the animals, and me and Father Rapolo took the patients until the patients were finally rescued, the ones that were still alive. And then it was just the animals, and it was just me.
How many did you lose, doctor, patients?
Me and Jody would stack up the dead bodies, you know, as they died, so that they wouldn't be lying in the same room with another patient who was alive. It must have been at least 5.
Your true crime podcast keeps listeners on the edge of their seats. But here's the real mystery. Why isn't it making more money?
Odyssey Creator Lab is here to solve that. We host your show for free. No fees, no catch. You focus on the suspense while our sales team brings in advertisers and revenue. Stop leaving money on the table. Apply now at creators.odyssey.com and turn your passion for true crime into real revenue.
That died.
Do you hold any resentment at all toward the people that rescued, that took the military triage part as opposed to the approach as opposed to the medical triage approach?
I would say that I wondered, the hospital offered to come and get all of their patients. Metairie Road was the nearest high ground. Mm-hmm. They could have launched boats and come and got all the patients out and all the animals out.
Is the hospital you're talking about? The hospital? Or the
military? Yeah, the hospital.
Yeah.
Wow. The hospital. But they couldn't get permission. They were told by the people who were setting up the perimeter, no civilian rescue. There are people coming from all over the state to help. But the military thinking seems to be secure the perimeter. You know, they're responsible for the security of the area more than the lives of the patients. I thought, that's really... The hospital could just get these people out. You know, there were people driving, riding by in canoes. Mm. It was obvious that this didn't have to happen. So I thought, whoever's making a plan is making like one-size-fits-all plan for an entire city, where a little bit of nuanced thinking would have easily solved their problems.
But
there was one group of the hospital did not want to defy the orders of the authorities. Because they just, I guess, felt like they should follow what the people were telling them. The one group that I saw that was openly defying the rule, no civilian rescue, was the SPCA. They were going building to building, tapping on windows, listening for barks and mews, you know, and Louisiana SPCA had one boat there, and they were so full of dogs they couldn't carry anymore. And when they finally saw my pack of dogs, they asked if they could drop one off with me because they had more than they could carry. So I took one of theirs, who ended up being, of course, not having a family, you know, to return to. All the other ones, their families came and got them. But this one was the extra one. But I did hear from one of my sister's friends from Houston that the dog was eventually adopted.
So in all of this with the patients, you still had the compassion and the energy to help with the pets, right, and rescue them. And at one point, you interacted with Matthew McConaughey?
Well, the other three people left when all the patients were rescued, finally. The remaining patients were rescued. Mm-hmm. So now it was just me and the, like, 70 animals. But Cheryl and... Jody had set it up so well. All I had to do was walk around twice a day and feed them all in their cages and take them for little walks. They had a dog walk on the fifth or sixth floor or something like that. And so it really wasn't that hard. I even played with the animals sometimes. It didn't get tough until Aviation Inc. set a helicopter in. Somehow my wife convinced the hospital to pay for animal rescue with help by helicopter because she was fighting on the phone with them. And they were determined to send a vet in to euthanize the animals, and she was threatening them that that would lead to very bad consequences if they did that. So finally, when they did that, they came in, and the helicopter landed, and we moved them all out to this little post office island behind the hospital because the post office was the one place slightly above the water level. Mm-hmm. But then another helicopter landed from the same company close by, and the downwash of the second helicopter caused the first helicopter to tip over and the engine exploded.
Oh, Lord.
So now that Huey was on its side. The pilot, fortunately, was still intact. He didn't die, which it looked like he would because it's a big explosion. But now the rescue was canceled. All the animals had to go back, be taken back into the hospital, and then it started to rain. Now instead of being up in their cages on the fifth or sixth floor, they were all running around the floors, pooping and peeing and sometimes fighting with each other. And it was just me and 70 animals in a couple of rooms with linoleum floors. I was running around grabbing sheets, putting them on the floor, not knowing if anyone was going to come back. And this, when they came back again the next day, or maybe 2 days later, I can't remember, there was a guy.
You were there for a week.
Let me interrupt both of you. Doctor, I know you got patience, but I can't. I don't know how I can let this story end right here. Do you have any more time or not?
My colleagues are watching the floor for me.
So that's a yes or no?
I don't want to take any more of your time. I mean,
I want to hear the story. If you don't worry about my time, I want to hear your story. This is a compelling.
I know the story as well, if not better than he does.
All right, well, and Jamie, we'll stick with you when we come back, and we'll finish the story. And Doctor, you can go if you want, or stay if you can. Either way, it's 7:31. Time for WWL First News. For that, we go to Ian Ozan. Back with Tommy Tucker, WWL. Back with James Riopelle, an anesthesiologist. Rode out the storm, eschewed rescue, and stayed with the patients that were there. Jamie Manders, his wife. Jamie, you were there as well, right?
Well, I was there only until the very first boat came, because I had my 83-year-old mother with dementia with me. And so my husband said, you've got to get out. I'm going to stay. He wasn't telling anybody at that point. He said, I'm going to stay with the animals. He says, they want me to.
Well, the animals and the patients, right?
Well, he didn't know about the patients at this point. When he put my mother and I on a boat, he said, I'm going to stay for the animals. I'm not telling anybody because I'm going to stay illegally. I can disappear into this hospital and they can't find me because it was dark.
Wow.
And so he said, your job is going to be work the internet, work whatever you can and get me rescued, but I will not leave until they take all the animals and save them, not euthanize them. So that was my charge. I got to Houston the next day. My brother lives in Houston. He came and got me. But once we were dumped off at Veterans and Causeway in the masses out there. So anyway, James was in the hospital. He only had we had push to talk cell phones, and he could not charge his cell phone. Mm-hmm. So we could only talk to each other for about 30 minutes a night.
These Nextel things like that?
What?
Push to talk like these Nextel things, whatever it was.
They were the flip phones, you
okay,
know. They
I gotcha.
were that's what they had back then,
okay,
you know.
Yeah.
And basically that because the cell phones didn't work. It was just this push to talk function worked. So that's how we kept in touch. So I made sure he was alive every night. So because he was there by himself for a week. And he only had leftover food was left there. The patients had left behind when they left, and I managed to get somebody to drop cat and dog food on the hospital so that he could feed the animals. The only way he had water was that they drained. But before I left, the doctors drained all the water out of the pipes because they couldn't get new water, and they had to mix it. They had a pharmacist that showed them how much bleach to put in there to make it drinkable. So that's all that James had was this drinkable to drink and to give to the animals. So he was there because he promised the patients that were leaving their animals because they were crying and everything. They didn't want to leave their animals. And he says, I'm not leaving until they rescue them. So I was working the internet all this time, day and night. And I'm not exactly, well, basically, I managed to get in touch with an anesthesiologist friend of ours in New York who was smart enough to get in touch with the owner of the hospital, and they got me on the phone, and they were trying to force me to allow them to send in a veterinarian who would euthanize all the animals. And I said, I knew they had left him two guns to in case he needed them. And I said, he's got a gun and he's not afraid to use them. Well, of course, that ended up getting him into a lot of trouble, but they weren't going to send anybody in. And so I do not know how this happened, but eventually Oprah Winfrey heard about this. And she sent Matthew McConaughey, who my husband never heard of at that point.
Hang on a second. Dr. James Riopelle. So you, Matthew McConaughey, comes to the hospital. You had no idea who he was?
I thought he was a reporter. He was asking me, was I there? The doctor was there to help the animals. And he had a cameraman with him, so I figured he's a reporter.
That's kind of humbling to him, I would think, right?
Well, he did great. I mean, there was a boat that had a little bit of gas in it that someone had done our rescued a patient, come back and got a liver transplant patient. That was Dr. Ram Charan. Mm-hmm. He was terrified of water, but he came all the way back to get that patient out of there. And he got two of them out, and he got them on the boat, but they had to leave the boat behind after they did the rescue. So the boat was there. So I didn't know how to drive a boat, but I had a key around my neck because someone had given it to me. And so when I asked him, you know, could he drive a boat, he said yes. And he drove all the animals back and forth to the island to to get to be rescued the second time. And after they'd been brought to the hospital, he was part of the second rescue team. And, he, you know, it was all put on Oprah Winfrey. And, you know, I thought he was just a cub reporter who was there to help out.
I'm sorry to laugh, but I'm looking at the picture here of you with the key around your neck, which apparently is the boat key. Matthew McConaughey, one of the big movie stars of the time, says, yeah, I can drive a boat. So he takes the animals, and he did. Yeah, see the pictures of it right here. Let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back. 751 traffic, WWL. 7:56 now, a couple of minutes left with Dr. James Riopelle and anesthesiologist Jamie Manders, his wife, who rode out Katrina at Lindy Boggs Hospital. Jamie left because her husband told her to. The doctor stayed behind to care for pets initially and then patients that he learned were not going to be rescued. I got to ask you individually, Jamie, how did it change your life, the whole experience?
Not a lot.
Really?
James is a pretty heroic, fabulous guy. And fortunately for us, our home was fine, high and dry, and was not harmed by Katrina. So, of course, the only two animals that died were my two cats
Left
with James, and unfortunately, they died.
I'm sorry.
But everybody else lived. So this was a wonderful story, and a lot of people that their animals are rescued, we have heard from them through the years and how grateful they were. But that is so like James. He's that kind of person.
James, do you consider yourself a hero?
I saw heroism around me constantly. I remember one night I heard a helicopter pitch black outside. I thought, what were they doing flying a helicopter at midnight over a hospital? If they'd gone down another few feet, they probably would have got their helicopter blades caught in the wires. A rope drops down. A man is crawling down the rope, rescuing someone in the water that someone's reported. Mm. Up goes the rope and the two people, and off they go. You know, this is just the kind of thing you see people at their best and people at their worst during a crisis.
Has it changed you at all?
It's made me aware that when really big decisions are made that affect large numbers of people, the little people can get lost in the shuffle. There were many, many things that could have been done better, but because of decisions being made on a massive scale, there was just no resources allocated to a lot of fairly easy solutions that I could see.
Have you kept up with anybody that was at the hospital or any pet owners or even Matthew McConaughey?
Well, Jody Patterson, I took him out with his mother to tell her all how great he was helping me with the patients and animals. And Cheryl Martin became a nursing supervisor out at Kenner, where I worked after the storm, and we would have long conversations about life. Unfortunately, she died last year. I would send her birthday cards and stuff. Matthew McConaughey is, just great for the one day that I had him.
I appreciate your stories, both of y'all. You are, and both of you, are true heroes, and unfortunately, those stories don't get told a lot, and sometimes the people that do the most work, Doc, you're the real deal. In this job that I've had for a long time now, the people that are all braggadocious and everything else, they're not the real deal. The people that are the real deal are the ones that are quiet, and you, sir, are the real deal. Thank you for your time. Jamie, thank you for your time as well and for what you did during Katrina. Y'all have a great day, okay?
Thank you for a chance to tell our story.
You bet. Thank you. Thank you both. We'll take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk to Jeff Nowak, WWL Saints sideline reporter and digital producer, take another look back at the game on Saturday, against the Broncos, and who can make the 53-man roster and who's getting cut. We'll talk about it when we come back, WWL. 8:16 now, Jeff Nowak joins us, WWL contributor and Saints sideline reporter. How you doing, Jeff?
Doing good, Tommy. How about yourself?
I'm all right. Tough day for, if ever you've seen Hard Knocks, it's just so uncomfortable, and it hurts you in a way to see a player cut, because I don't know about you, but I've been cut from teams before, and it just hurts. It's like, okay, we gave you a chance, but you're just not good enough, and you can hopefully have another chance or hopefully work harder or find something else to do. Tell me any notable cuts so far.
Yeah, so this year the Saints, you know, I don't know if it's a Kellen Moore thing, if they decided to move things up, but they made 14 cuts yesterday. Mm-hmm. You got to make 37 total. It's a lot of cuts. You know, in the past they would have had, like, you know, cut down to 80 here, cut down to 70 here. Now you just do it all at the end. So it's a lot. It's kind of a bloodbath, to if you want to use kind of a graphic term. Like, it's a third of the roster that's been with you throughout camp is suddenly gone. And so they moved on from 14 players yesterday. And I think that's smart because, you know, there are difficult decisions. You know, there's no easy cuts, but there are, you know, simpler decisions. And there are typically going to be a dozen to 14 players that you can kind of be like, all right, let's get this out of the way. I wouldn't say there are any major cuts. We do have a list up at WWL.com. We have a tracker going if you want to follow along there. You know, Cam Akers, the veteran running back, is probably the biggest name on that list. They also cut James Burnup, who, you know, was one of the two players in the punter battle. So that kind of tells you, hey, Kai Kroger is going to be your punter.
I want to ask you about that, because punters are not important until you need them, right? When they punter, you need them to kick the ball deep. No, I'm serious about this. Yeah. So this guy's a rookie as well, correct?
Yeah, so both players that were in the competition were rookies, because the returning punter from last year, Matthew Hayball, was cut earlier in camp. It's going to be the third consecutive season they've gone with a rookie punter, which, I don't know, personally I find kind of annoying. I think, like you look at Blake Groupie, for example, he looks like a completely different player mm-hmm. than he did in year one. It's because he's a third-year player. He's confident. Mm-hmm. You know, and there's a certain level of, hey, why not just hang on to a punter for 2 years and see if he can improve year over year? That's not what they're doing. They're sticking with the UDFA route. And so, yeah, Kai Kroger, who's a guy who started camp with the Jets, got cut. Saints picked him up. He was at South Carolina last year. I wouldn't say that he had a particularly impressive camp, but he was ahead. And you could tell because he was holding for Blake Groupie's kicks. He was the first guy off the bench. They only punted one time against the Broncos, which I'm sure if I'm James Burnup, I'm kind of annoyed about, because I didn't even get a chance mm-hmm. to, you know, to really compete.
You know what you just said there, holding for Blake Groupie, that might have been a difference maker, because if Blake is comfortable with him and Blake is just on fire, right? So why fool with that?
Yeah, it's the one part of punting that no one ever really talks about, which is, hey, you know, if you, because you see kickers miss kicks, and everyone always talks about, wow, the kicker missed. They never talk about, oh, was the hold good? You know, was the operation good?
Well, and it goes back to,
it's not, right?
It goes back to what you said about being comfortable, about Blake Groupie, confident and comfortable, and the holder's got a lot to do with that.
Yeah, and I think a lot of it is more of a continuity thing. Like, mm-hmm. I think most people could go out there and hold. I think you, if you practiced enough, could go out there and hold for a kick, right?
Nope.
No, you don't think so?
No hand-eye coordination, Jeff. Sorry, can't do it.
Oh, good to know. Yeah. I'll keep that in mind if we ever get in that situation.
Yeah, please do that. No hand-eye coordination at all, but that's why you want to bet me when we play golf. All right, let me take a break. We come back, we'll talk about running back and quarterback, because it is an interesting situation at running back, and also quarterback. I think we kind of know what's going to happen, but we'll see. Jeff Nowak, our guest, WWL Saints sideline reporter and WWL contributor, 820 traffic now on WWL. At 826, Tommy Tucker, WWL, cut down day. 3 o'clock is when the final cuts come in. Devin Neal tweeting, or Xing, however you want to say it, that the NFL, a crazy place. Let's talk about the Saints running back position. You know Alvin Kamara is going to be there. Take me from there.
Yeah, so I think it was actually Cam Akers that tweeted that.
Hold on, what did I say?
Devin Neal's the
rookie. No, Cam Akers tweeted that. You're right. Thank you, Jeff. I was more concerned with X and Twitter than I was the player.
Yeah, I would have been concerned if Devin Neal was tweeting that, because I think Devin Neal did enough. You know, he was a tough guy to project. You know, I put out my final roster projection before the final preseason game, which isn't necessarily fair, but I just think that's, you know, I don't think a ton gets changed in the final preseason game. I think there's a few roster spots that maybe change, but Devin's case is one that I think, you know, he probably did need to go out there and show something, just because he's been hurt. He got hurt in the final, or the first scrimmage the Saints had, that one they had where they ran 126 plays. He picked up a hamstring injury, kept him out a couple weeks. He wasn't able to get into either of the first two preseason games. He wasn't able to get into the joint practice with the Rams. So this is really the first chance you got to see him out there in a competitive setting. And I thought he looked good.
Kendra Miller. Yeah, I just want to move you along here because I don't want to lose time. Kendra Miller was in a doghouse with Dennis Allen, who ain't Dan no more. So tell me his story, his situation.
Yeah, he's healthy. You know, he's been consistent. That's what Kellen Moore has talked about. You know, they wanted to get him out there and just have him be productive, and that's what he was. It was an interesting situation because they had Alvin Kamara active for the final preseason game. He went in for the first snap. He wasn't even wearing the tape on the back of his arm, so he knew he wasn't going to be in there very long, and that ended up being his only snap. He came out immediately, and it was Kendra Miller, and that's kind of been what we've seen. He's kind of locked in my opinion, to that RB2 spot, and so I'm excited. I'm excited for him to get into a regular season healthy. It's the first training camp that he's gotten through without any injury issues.
How many do they keep, Jeff?
I think they keep four. I think they keep Alvin, obviously, Kendra, and then I would say Devin Neal. And the final question is Velus Jones versus Clyde Edwards-Helaire.
And does that come down to special teams?
Yes, I think it does, in the speed. I think Velus just has that 4.31, 4.32 speed that is hard to replicate at the running back position. And he
ain't nothing beat speed. You know that. Ain't nothing beat speed, as long as you can hang on to football. Let's talk quarterback. How do you see that playing out?
Well, I mean, I think you're keeping all three. I think Jay Kaner's going to stick around on the roster. Yeah, I think people underestimate the value of that third quarterback until you get one quarterback injury and suddenly he's your backup and you want a guy that knows your offense. He can be active on game days in the sense of you can have that emergency third quarterback, so it just makes sense to keep him. I still think it's Rattler. You know, Kellen might surprise us. I would be surprised if we hear an announcement today. I think today's about the cuts. Tomorrow will be about the quarterback, and then you're going to move into Arizona. But yeah, I'd think it's Rattler, and then Shuck will probably play this season based on how things go.
I wouldn't even announce a starter. Why?
Yeah, I mean,
keep guessing, Arizona. Keep guessing. We're going to give them both reps.
Stop asking questions. That's what it is.
Tell me about a surprise name we might hear today being cut.
Oh, that's a tough one. Probably Isaiah Foskey. I don't know how much of a surprise it is, but it's rare to see a second round pick get cut on his rookie deal. So that's what I'll go with.
All right. Thank you, Jeff. A pleasure as always. We'll talk to you again soon. Jeff Nowak, WWL contributor, Saints sideline reporter. Didn't mean to rush you along, but I wanted to get all the information in. We'll take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk to Barry Keim, LSU health climatologist, about what it was like during Katrina and how hurricane forecasting has changed since then. Right now, time for WWL First News. For that, we go to Ian Ozan. 8:45, quarter till 9, we continue to spend the week reflecting on Katrina on this 20th anniversary. Barry Keim joins us, LSU health climatologist, to talk what it was like to be the state climatologist during Katrina and how hurricane forecasting has changed since then. He's our friend. How you doing, Barry?
Hey, I'm doing very well. Good to be with you.
You know, I was saying before you came on that, okay, you want to be a meteorologist. All right, you got it. Here we go, hurricane out in the Gulf. Is it coming here or not? Do we evacuate or not? Do I close my business or not? What do we do? Up to you. But God forbid you're wrong, right?
Oh, yeah, exactly. We get basically all of the blame and very little of the credit. I mean, I say that partly kidding, but nevertheless.
No, I think it's right. I don't think anybody ever remembers when you get the forecast right. But God forbid you get it wrong. Look out. Those guys, we're 50% wrong. Let's talk about Katrina. You take me back to you're the state climatologist. Friday, you're watching this thing. That's when I think it first made a turn or maybe seemed like it was heading this way.
Well, yes. So I was teaching class on Thursday. I remember telling my students, you know, Tuesday, Thursday class. It's like, yeah, this storm, it's going to hit Florida. It's Florida's problem. It's going to hit the panhandle. Mm-hmm. I'll see y'all next week. Well, needless to say, that didn't happen exactly. So what basically happened, though, is the Hurricane Center did have the storm crossing over Florida and making a landfall up in the panhandle of Florida, and we really thought we were going to be okay. That forecast kind of held going into Friday. As the day went on Friday, the track kept kind of shifting a little bit further to the west. And it wasn't until Friday night at the 10 o'clock Central Time, 10 p.m. advisory, did they put the track coming right over, you know, Plaquemines and St. Bernard Parish and crushing New Orleans and the Mississippi coast.
What changed, Barry, climate-wise or from a meteorological standpoint, what changed that shifted the hurricane over?
Oh, well, I mean, obviously when they're doing those forecasts, they're running all sorts of models. As there's millions, even billions of equations in these models with all these systems kind of interacting with each other. And I mean, you know, we're talking about a very small shift, really. I mean, from the Florida Panhandle to New Orleans, I know it's a big shift in terms of the impacts, but in terms of the modeling, I mean, that's a relatively small shift. And so the dynamics were such that the storm just got shoved a little further westward, and all hell broke loose, obviously. So,
and to be clear, Katrina crossed southern Plaquemines and then hit Mississippi, but missed the city. It was the levee failures that did the city in, right?
Oh, absolutely. So the storm actually made landfall at Burris.
Mm-hmm.
It crossed over kind of the central part of St. Bernard Parish, you know, crossed over Lake Bourne, and then made landfall pretty much right near the Pearl River, you know, between Louisiana and Mississippi. But keep in mind, you know, the right-hand side of the storm mm-hmm. is where the biggest surge comes in, where the highest winds are. We were, believe it or not, on the weak side of the storm. Thank goodness. Otherwise, it would have been a whole lot worse here. But, you know, Mississippi had that 28-foot storm surge on the coastline. So, and that's the biggest surge we have on record in the Gulf of Mexico anywhere.
Was Katrina the biggest? Somebody told me the other day that it was so big it wouldn't even fit on a TV screen. And that's when they knew it was time to evacuate. Was Katrina the biggest storm ever? Hurricane?
No. That title probably belongs, and I'm blanking on the storm here, the one that hit up on the East Coast. It was only a Category
Sandy?
1. Sandy, yes, okay. Exactly. Sandy was enormous in terms of its spatial dimensions. Katrina wasn't small by any stretch, but give you some idea, the eye of Hurricane Katrina was about the size of Lake Pontchartrain, mm-hmm. like 40 miles across.
Mm-hmm.
So it had a very large, very incredibly well-defined eye because it was, you know, it really was kind of a perfect storm. And, I can give you a little history of it. The storm formed over the Bahamas.
You're reading ahead, Barry. That was my next question. Go ahead.
It formed over the Bahamas, took a very, very slow track over Florida. It was only a Category 1, but the fact that it was moving so slow, and the extended exposure, it caused a lot of damage in South Florida for a Category 1 hurricane. But then once it entered the Gulf of Mexico, it got out over something we call the loop current. The loop current is some incredibly warm water that comes in from the Caribbean, and it's loaded with energy, and it passed over that loop current and got over that, you know, all that energy and just exploded in intensity all the way up to a Category 5. At one point, it had winds, you know, between 170 and 175 mile an hour sustained. And the gusts are usually about 30% greater than that. So we had gusts well over 200 miles an hour in that storm at that time. And 18 hours before landfall, it was still a Category 5. But the water started to cool off as it got a little closer to the coast. Again, making landfall, you know, on that early Sunday morning, it was about 6 o'clock in the morning, came in at Burris. But it was only a Category 3, and I say only, still a major hurricane, but it was still packing a Category 5 storm surge that it had built up earlier in the Gulf. And that's what slammed into Mississippi and then also got pushed into Lake Pontchartrain and then onto New Orleans.
It's funny how memories fade after 20 years. I thought it started as a wave off of Africa, and it did not. 8:51, we'll pick it up, Barry, when we come back, talk about how forecasting has changed since then. It's 8:51, 9 till 9, traffic now, WWL. 8:56, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Barry Keim, who was a Louisiana State climatologist when Katrina hit back in 2004. And I'm looking at a timeline here on 8:26 would have been the Friday. That's when I first noticed it kind of heading toward the west. And I called a sales guy in at about 3 in the afternoon and said, Friday afternoon, you might want to look at this because it doesn't seem to be going like they said it was going to go. Anyway, we know the rest is history. Barry, how is forecasting changed? Somebody texted in about Nash and his black marker. And look, I met Nash Roberts one time. He was an extremely nice man, a gentleman extraordinaire. But tell me how forecasting has changed since the days of Nash and his black marker to Katrina to now.
Well, I'm glad you brought up Nash. Yeah, he was an interesting character, certainly much beloved across New Orleans. But, you know, forecasting has come a long way since then. Back then, a lot of it was, you know, kind of off the seat of your pants. Mm-hmm. Now, we have faster, more powerful computing that really drives all of it. And, you know, we have these models now that simulate the storm structure, the inner core.
Your true crime podcast keeps listeners on the edge of their seats. But here's the real mystery.
why isn't it making more money? Odyssey Creator Lab is here to solve that. We host your show for free. No fees, no catch. You focus on the suspense, while our sales team brings in advertisers and revenue. Stop leaving money on the table. Apply now at creators.odyssey.com and turn your passion for true crime into real revenue.
For dynamics, you know, simulating the eye. And we also have, you know, we have the hurricane hunting planes, and we also have hurricane hunting drones that we didn't even have during Katrina. And they do ensemble forecasting where, it used to be they would just do one run on a computer. Now they do many, many runs with very, very slight variations in the initial conditions, because it's hard to get those initial conditions exactly right. And the improvements have been dramatic just since Katrina's time, so 20 years. The two-day forecast, the error rate used to be about 300 miles, about 120. On the two-day forecast, it was about 120 miles. Now it's more like 60, so we pretty much cut that in half. And then the five-day forecast errors were about 300 miles. Now they're about 150. So that's a pretty big deal. And eventually, the hope is that we don't have a cone of error anymore, no more cone of uncertainty. It's just a straight line, and we know exactly where that storm's going to go. We're not there yet, but that cone is getting narrower and narrower. So, improvements have been happening, and hopefully we'll keep that going.
AI is all about crunching numbers and scenarios rapidly. Is that playing a part in this?
Oh, absolutely. AI is playing a huge role in all of this. And I do think this could take us very far and get us a little closer to that straight line rather than a cone of uncertainty.
Awesome. Thank you, Barry. I appreciate it. What was it like for you? Real quick, we got 20 seconds left. Just tell me, were you surprised by the path of Katrina or not?
Say that again?
Were you surprised by it?
Oh, by the storm? Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is the storm we had talked about for decades, and to have it actually happen is just amazing.
Thank you, Barry.
I'll just end with a go Chalmette Owls.
All right, there you go. All right, go Shaw Eagles. We'll take a break. We come back. We're going to talk about the LSU Tigers here on WWL. All right, here we go into the home stretch. Tim Zimmer brings it to my imagination that as we attention that as we remember Katrina 20 years ago, LSU was set to play Arizona State in 2005, and they kept pushing that game back and back and back and back and back. Now it's 2030 they're set to play the game to make up that they missed in 2005, 25 years later. Jeff Palermo joins us now, WWL.com columnist, to talk about those LSU Tigers. How you doing, Jeff?
Hey, Tommy, how you doing?
We're getting to it, aren't we?
We're getting there, man. We're getting there. Only a few more days left.
Tell me what's going on at practice, what's going on with LSU.
Well, there's a lot going on. Obviously, the preparation here for the Clemson Tigers, there's a lot of different things I could hit on, Tommy. I guess I'll try to go off the top of my head on what are some of the big talking points at the moment. First of all, this team looks like it's healthy. I know there's been a couple of practices where the media were able to observe and Garrett Nussmeier was not throwing. They had him on a pitch count here during the preseason camp. And then, of course, he had a little bit of that knee issue as well. But looks like he's ready to go. And LSU made it all the way through here through this entire preseason camp without a major injury.
Yeah, probably shouldn't have said that if they're still hitting.
What's that?
I say you probably shouldn't have said that if they're still hitting. But are they or not?
I mean,
you'd think they'd taper that off. Today's Tuesday.
I don't think what I can say, Tommy's going to result in an
injury. You're right.
I don't know. I'm not. I don't believe in the broadcaster's jinx. But last year they had an injury to Chris Hilton towards the end of preseason camp, and that really, even though Garrett Nussmeier threw for 4,000 yards, that really hampered the passing game because they were missing that deep threat that Chris Hilton possesses, and they got him. They got Barry and Brown. LSU's going to be able to stretch the field a lot more. Coach Brian Kelly feels really good about this defense. He loves the experience that he has on that defense. I talked about that in the story that I have up at WWL.com right now. And then I think the other big story is the offensive line. They have still not settled on a starting five.
But is that good? Is that good that they haven't settled?
What's that, Tommy?
Is that good that they haven't settled on a starting five?
I'm not crazy about it.
Okay. The reason I ask is, does it mean they have so much talent, it's hard to pick the best five, or does it mean it's hard to find five guys that can play?
Well, I think what you want is, especially going into this game against another top 10 opponent on the road in a hostile environment, I would like to have the starting five set, that these are the five guys we're going with. Mm-hmm. So you can have the communication down. You can have the teamwork down, the chemistry down, all of that. I'm not a big fan of going into this game swapping guys out. Now, granted, I think the idea is LSU will decide on a starting five, of course, and they're going to hope that that five will be, they'll be so good from the start that there's no reason to sub anybody in or out.
Mm-hmm.
But the plan right now at this point is to play as many as eight guys on that offensive line. If LSU was playing Louisiana Tech and wanted to shuffle some guys in and out, if LSU was playing Southeastern Louisiana this week and wanted to shuffle some guys in and out, I think that's fine. But this is going to be a game where you can't afford to have critical mistakes. You can't have protection breakdowns. Missed blocks could cost you big in a game like this that's expected to be so close. So it's not ideal, but it's the situation that they have right now.
So again, is it because they are so talented, or they're finding five guys that can play? That's what I'm trying to figure out.
I think the competition is just close. I think it's a lot like what you're seeing with the Saints quarterback situation, in that you have Spencer Rattler and Tyler Shuck.
Well, but wait, no, hang on a second. We're not talking about Jaden Daniels, or give me another great quarterback.
Joe
Burrow. Yeah, we're not talking about that, are we, when it comes to offensive linemen?
I think what you're looking at is, just like with the Saints QB situation, there's a lot that the coaching staff likes with Rattler, and there's a lot that the coaching staff likes with Shuck. And it's hard to make the determination who's the better guy. Brian Kelly broke it down yesterday about, the offensive linemen that they have, and in particular the guards that they have, and DJ Chester and Paul Mbanga and Cohen Echols. And all three of those guys can do different things. Cohen Echols is one of the strongest guys on the team. Mbanga is a guy that can really move very well. DJ Chester is a guy that has a lot of experience being the starting center last year. And so there's just this, none of them have been able to separate themselves from the other. And so it's kind of tight. And so I think the coaching staff is like, let's just see what all these guys can do. They all deserve to play, is what they look at it. They just don't have someone that has stood out over the others.
You have a great story posted at WWL.com. Let me read the first line. Running quarterbacks caused problems for LSU's defense last year. Then you go on to talk about Lenoris Sellers with South Carolina, Marcel Reed with Texas A&M, Jalen Milroe, Alabama, and even Vanderbilt's Diego Pavia. Thoughts?
Well, the first real paragraph of the story brings just cold sweats to LSU fans, because that was the kryptonite of that LSU defense last year. They really struggled to contain quarterbacks that could run the football. I mean, what Jalen Milroe did to LSU last year was criminal. It was really bad for LSU's defense. For that guy to rush for 185 yards and four touchdowns inside Tiger Stadium was just brutal to watch for LSU fans.
I like the way you phrased it. He did wind sprints in Tiger Stadium.
Yeah, he did. I mean, he was, and then he just took a glass of, got a sip of glass of water, and went back out there and ran 40 more yards down the field. I mean, it was embarrassing. It was absolutely embarrassing, Tommy. And it's got to be a situation that has to be rectified this year. Now, they feel like they have. They feel like they, on the defensive line, they're just much better. They got some experience. I think that's the thing that Coach Brian Kelly likes about this defense, and that the transfer portal players weren't necessarily guys that were just, backups in another place and looking for an opportunity to start somewhere else. I mean, Jamari Butler, Patrick Payton, Jack Pyburn, those guys were major parts of their defense, of the teams that they played on defense last year. You know, the same with
in the defensive secondary. You're bringing in starters in Mansoor Delane, A.J. Halsey, Tamarcus Cooley. Jakeem Jackson was a starter at Florida last year before he got hurt. So I think he really likes the experience. And it just seems like Blake Baker has much more to work with this season. He just didn't have, and I'm talking about the defensive coordinator for LSU, he just didn't have any answers last year. When quarterbacks were running wild on LSU's defense, he couldn't really make an adjustment because he didn't have enough personnel to do it. I think they believe they have that this season.
How good can the secondary be?
I think it could be good. Is it going to be DBU? I don't think we're at that point yet. I think this should be a really good defensive secondary. I mean, really the one guy that's going to return as the starter is going to be Ashton Stamps, but Mansoor Delane has looked good at the other cornerback spot. I mean, A.J. Halsey, this kid has played a lot of football, picked off a bunch of passes at Houston last year. Tamarcus Cooley looks like your perfect nickelback. And then there's backups behind them. I mean, I think Deshaun Spears out of Denham Springs is still part of this. I think you'll eventually see D.J. Pickett, the fantastic freshman cornerback from Florida. I think he'll eventually find find some playing time out there. So the defensive secondary should be much improved.
I had my chair reupholstered just to get ready for Saturday with Arch Manning and Texas taking on Ohio State and LSU. Of course, you can hear all the action here on WWL on Saturday. I'll give you the details when we come back. Thank you, Jeff Palermo. Appreciate it as always.
All right. Sounds good, Tommy. Thank
you. Have a great day. All right. When we come back, we're going to talk to Dr. Judy Ho, clinical and forensic neuropsychologist, host of the Supercharged Life podcast. We're concerned about mental health here, and we're going to talk about close friends and how important is it for you to have close friends as you age. Tommy Tucker back in a flash, WWL. It is 9:26. Every other Tuesday, we know the importance of mental health, and we try to focus on that. Dr. Judy Hoke joins us now, clinical and forensic neuropsychologist, host of the Supercharged Life podcast. Dr. Judy, I just realized for the first time in all of this time, and I know you got Luca with you sometimes, that it's 7:26 in California where you join us, and we do appreciate you getting up to be with us.
Oh, absolutely. Actually, I'm usually up way earlier than this, but you actually caught me on a time change. I was out of town, and I'm, like, readjusting. So it is slightly earlier for me today, but only because I'm still adjusting from
slightly
time change in Hawaii.
Earlier. Oh, well, Hawaii. Well, it's tough duty. Somebody's got to do it, Dr. Judy. Thank you for taking on the task.
Sounds ridiculous.
That is no. It is quite a difference, though. People that have never been to Hawaii. You're a regular or not?
No. I mean, well, I haven't been in a long time. But
How'd you like it?
It was a great trip. It was awesome. Yeah, we went to Oahu this time. But yeah, in Oahu, it's 4:30 right now in the morning.
A lot of water between here and there. I had to be sedated. Yeah. I'm just saying, I had to be sedated because I don't swim.
It's a long flight from where you are, too.
I'm no surfer. It is. I'm no surfer. But I had to be heavily sedated because that's a lot of water. We're going to talk about friendships today and cultivating friendships as an adult. I've heard numerous people say, and I've had the pleasure of this happening with one person. And a matter of fact, I spent some time with him a couple of weeks ago. We have been friends since third grade. We've had our differences, and we were laughing about that over the weekend a couple of weeks ago. But this is the person, the friend that you don't talk to every day. You talk to them every 6 months, maybe, but you pick it up exactly where you left off. Do you have a friend like that or friends?
I do. Yeah, I have a few friends like that. And they're from childhood. I mean, in a way, they're. Mm-hmm. I feel like it's childhood when it's college because you were a child. You were like 18 years old. So that's pretty much how we are. I mean, sometimes we won't talk for months. I have a friend who maybe I haven't even talked to in a year. But then we talk like five times in a month, you know, but it doesn't really matter, right? Because that connection is still there. And we don't really necessarily take offense to, you know, to not having talked in that time. I mean, things get busy and you don't necessarily even have to explain yourself. You just pick back up and it feels like old times, you know, and I definitely have a couple of friends like that. And I really cherish those friendships.
We've had our troubles in eighth grade. I think it was eighth grade. I kicked the football in high school and he moved the ball one time. And I threw him down on the ground and started started choking him. I had a bad temper at that time. Yes, and he told me, it's not worth going to jail over. That's how he said he got me off of him. I don't know if that's true or not, but it's a funny story. Oh, and then later on, I got mad at him because he humiliated me on a tennis court because he's an athlete and I'm not. But we put it together, and we've stayed friends throughout. How hard is it for older people to make friends or adults to make friends if, for whatever reason, you've moved away or those connections like we're talking about? First of all, let me take a step back. Does everybody have a friend like that, or are we lucky?
I would like to consider us lucky. I think we're blessed to have friends like that. I don't know if everybody does. I think maybe people sometimes did, and then something got in the way, and they stopped connecting, or, you know, sometimes people can still have falling outs at an older age. Like, everything seems fine, but then all of a sudden, one person does something, and the other person's not happy about it. They don't talk about it, and that friendship goes away. So I don't think everybody has somebody like that.
Tell me the importance of having friends.
Well, social connection is vital to not only our survival, but for us to thrive and to feel good. It's good for our physical and mental health. It's been proven in, you know, a ton of studies. And so when people tell me that they don't need friends, you still need connection. And so maybe sometimes people will say, I don't need friends because I have family. I mean, that of course, it counts. But at the same time, sometimes there are rifts in the family. Sometimes there's complicated things that happen. And you might need somebody to talk to you and get you through that, or just to share an interest that maybe you don't share with other family members. And so, you know, the bottom line is we all need a few people we can connect with and count on. And it's helpful to have somebody outside of the family just because the dynamics within the family aren't really, you know, conducive to, you know, having peace all the time just because things come up. And so it's nice to have something stable outside of that as well. And you don't need a lot, but you do need quality connections.
Mark Twain said that the proper office of a friend is to side with you when you are in the wrong. Nearly anybody will side with you when you are in the right. But part of being a friend is, and a friendship is, being able to tell somebody when they're a little bit off base, right?
Yeah, you want to be able to have friends who are not just yes people, but people who are actually going to be honest with you, because it's not always easy, right, to hear something difficult. But if it's a true friend, you trust in the quality of your connection, and also it's usually for the person's own good that they hear the truth. And so you need somebody like that that's not just going to pat you on the back when things are going well, but actually say, hey, you know what, like, this is a tough thing, or you made a mistake, or, you know, even though you did something that wasn't the best, I'm still here for you. You know, you do need somebody like that. And I do think that sometimes those people, either one, could be hard to find, or two, sometimes people, as they get older, they just start getting embarrassed about calling their friend and leaning on them for support. Like, oh, I don't really want to call them. I feel bad calling them. I haven't talked to them in months, and now I'm just going to call and talk about myself. Well, if it's one of those true friends, like Tommy, you and I were talking about, hopefully that won't get in the way of you trying to connect with them. And hopefully your friend will welcome you with open arms and be like, it's all good. Like, we can totally talk about you today. It's not a big deal.
Somebody once said, if you have two friends in your lifetime, you're lucky. If you have one, you're more than lucky. And then somebody else said, if you have more than like three, you're a fool, that they can't really be your friends. Is it possible to have, you know, you hear 20 of my closest friends, 30 of my closest friends? Can you really have 30 close friends?
I don't think that most people can keep up those connections, because it's really hard to have quality connections that's that voluminous, because
your true crime podcast keeps listeners on the edge of their seats. But here's the real mystery. Why isn't it making more money? Odyssey Creator Lab is here to solve that. We host your show for free. No fees, no catch. You focus on the suspense while our sales team brings in advertisers and revenue. Stop leaving money on the table. Apply now at creators.odyssey.com and turn your passion for true crime into real revenue.
Because each relationship takes time to cultivate and grow. So unless you have all the time in the world, I think that that's definitely a much taller task. I'm not going to say it's impossible. I just don't think that many people can pull that off.
Is there a litmus test for friendship? I always say, if you don't know where they live, if you don't know their phone number, and if you don't know what they do for a living, or if they're married, have kids, they're not really a friend. They're more of an acquaintance or an associate. Thoughts?
Yeah, I think that that's a good rule of thumb. I mean, if you don't know certain, what I would call what you just listed right there, relatively basic fundamental details about somebody, then that's not a close friend, right? That's somebody that you get along with, that you hang with. There's definitely some support that they offer. There's some value they probably add in your life, but they might not be a true friend.
When it comes to good friends or true friends, that's fine, but how important is it to have some small moments of connection with people just to interact people? I'm bad for that. I kind of see myself in a Geico commercial because, man, my kid just goes crazy rolling the eyes and everything else because I talk to people in elevators. I talk to people in grocery stores and everything. I just strike up conversations because I like to talk to people or at gas stations in a Geico commercial or whatever the hell it is. Is it Geico? I think it's the Geico commercial. Anyway,
I think, maybe.
Yeah. Anyway, do you ever see yourself in those commercials? And secondly, how important are those little connections?
Yeah. So those are called micro connections. I actually talked about that in a recent podcast and newsletter of mine. So it's really interesting you bring that up.
I do think
that it makes a big difference. So again, they're called micro connections. Essentially, it's, you know, your local barista you order coffee from once or twice a week. It's a person you just see down the street and you wave hi and you actually stop to ask how they're doing, even though you don't know them. They're maybe a stranger. Those things still count, you know, just having just that brief moment of a real connection with somebody who you might have a very peripheral relationship or even no relationship with. Those things really matter because they actually do have some of those same physical and mental health benefits that we were just discussing, you know, improving mood, spiking serotonin and spiking oxytocin. These are feel-good chemicals and bonding chemicals, lowering stress, lowering cortisol, taking you out of a fight-or-flight response, putting you in the moment. It's a form of mindfulness. And also, you brighten someone else's day. There's definitely been times where someone's brightened my day by saying hi to me and saying something or making a joke. Or there's times when hopefully I've brightened somebody's day because I've stopped and actually asked them, you know, a substantial, meaningful question or, you know, showed some curiosity about their life. And you see that their eyes light up. You know, you can make a difference as well in someone else's life, even for that moment. And then that makes you feel good as well. Kind of comes back to you. So those connections are extremely important.
I know fear of rejection can keep people from interacting with other people. Not me, because, you know, I'll throw you on the ground and choke you if you move the football. Kidding. That was in eighth grade. but I figure, you know, I'm going to talk to you. And if you don't want to talk to me, don't talk to me. And you miss the chance to have a nice conversation. That's the way I look at it. So I don't let it hold me back. What would you say to people that are hesitant because of fear of rejection to have these micro connections?
Yeah, well, first I would say that there's definitely a spectrum of people who are discomforted by social interactions of varying kinds, anything from mild social anxiety to maybe even fully having the symptoms of a social anxiety disorder.
On the spectrum somewhere, you know, you're talking about, right?
Last week was not talking about that spectrum, but I was talking about just a spectrum of social anxiety.
Okay.
That some people have some degree of social anxiety, and then some people really have a paralyzing degree of social anxiety where they actually have like the condition called social anxiety disorder. So of course I understand that, but at the same time, so much of it is built up in that person's head about how bad it could really be, how embarrassing it could be. It's always the worst case scenario. They fast forward to that right away. And so really, I think it's about getting comfortable gradually. It doesn't mean that you have to go strike up conversations at a huge party. It's just way too much social stimuli. Mm-hmm. But more like on a one-on-one basis, you know, when not everybody is looking at you, when maybe it's a space where it's not super public and there's not a huge audience, right? Because sometimes people might even be intimidated to like make a conversation with the local barista because there's a lot of people in the coffee house. Mm-hmm. And if the person doesn't give them, you know, doesn't give them any attention, they start feeling embarrassed. Well, what about if you're just walking on the sidewalk and you see somebody, there's nobody else around in your neighborhood. I just want to say hi and just say, hey, like, you know, what did I say this today? Oh, what's the name of your dog? I mean, those are less risky or stressful situations because there's not a lot of observers around. And then the more you practice, the better you get at it. And the more you'll realize that your worst nightmare isn't going to come true in these interactions.
I get a couple of texts coming in here. I saw Dr. Judy on a documentary with Steven Tyler and Aerosmith. Did you do that?
Yeah, I filmed that a little while ago, but it sounds like it may have just debuted recently, so that's cool. I'm so glad that they saw that show.
Good. I mean, well, you're all over TV. Can't miss you. I have tons of associates, maybe only four or five people that I call friends. Somebody else said, I have lots of friends and a huge family. I'm close to most, but no one I could not see in a while and play catch-up. Not have to play catch-up and pick up where you left off. Somebody else texted in, it's Progressive Insurance, which maybe goes to the nature of the advertising campaign that I remembered that I was like my father, but not necessarily the insurance company. Somebody else said, I swear that my wife has a Facebook friend that she met in line at Rouse's. That raised my eyebrows, but maybe it's a female friend, so maybe everything's so good. The best advice my dad ever gave me was to meet at least one new person every day, and if you don't have a good friend, make a friendly enemy to keep you sane. And here we go. What does the doctor think of people who have no friends and don't want any, and they're out in public, they go out of their way not to make eye contact with anybody? Do not answer, because we're going to take a break, and you can answer that when we come back. We're talking to Dr. Hoke, licensed clinical neuropsychologist, TV star. She's been all over the place. Host of the Supercharged Life podcast about friendships from the adult level, and we'll even go into the childhood part of it if we have time when we come back. 9:40, time for traffic, WWL. 9:45, Tommy Tucker, WWL, live to L.A. We go to talk to Dr. Judy Ho, clinical and forensic neuropsychologist, host of the Supercharged Life podcast, surfer as well, accurate?
You know, I would not call myself a good surfer, but sure.
I didn't say good. Let's say good. Do you surf?
I do, yeah.
There you go.
You are a surfer.
You're a surfer. Let it go with that. You may always what? Also what?
I make lots of surfer faux pas. I'm such a beginner, you know, like they're like, hey, you caught my wave. I'm like, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Well, just
I didn't know that you were in line for that one.
At least they didn't throw you on the ground and choke you.
Yeah, that's true.
And B, make sure you don't get et by a shark. All right. So before we went to the break, somebody said, what does the doctor think of people who have no friends, don't want any? When they're out in public, they go out of their way to not make eye contact with anybody. I know somebody like this. Thoughts?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I respect that everybody has a different bandwidth for how much social interaction they would like, but I would love to know if this person feels, you know, absolutely no joy from connecting with even one person on occasion, right? Not everybody needs social connection every single day with multiple people, but because we are biological beings that are built on social connection as a means for survival, we all need some of that to emotionally regulate and to feel our best as a species. And so again, everyone's bandwidth for how much they need, I think that's definitely up for contention. But does this person even enjoy talking to people once every week, somebody they really care about, having a true connection moment with somebody every once in a while? Because I would argue that it's kind of innate in our biology, and it's how we're evolutionarily built, and you can't completely fight that, even if you are maybe on the lower end of, you know, the range of how much you need.
This text is very interesting to me and very appropriate, and so I'm just going to read it, and then I'll make my comment. It says, lost a few childhood friends over politics. They say I'm evil and the devil for not being a Trump supporter. They all seem to be in a cult. Well, I guarantee you, the friends that this person lost thinks that this person is in a cult. Is it possible? Are we so divided as a country to let politics split up a friendship? Or it seems to me a lot better to just agree to disagree, because you're not going to change each other's minds.
Well, yeah, I mean, like you said, this is very relatable. And I would say that I feel like up until the last couple of years, people were able to agree to disagree. And I don't know if that's just my perception, but I've talked to a lot of people and they seem to be a point in this, that it's really the last couple of years where things have gotten so divided that I have heard this breaking friendships, marriages, relationships between family members, parents and children, et cetera. I think before people might just make a snarky joke about it, or maybe you just avoid that topic with that person. Or you just, like you said, agree to disagree. You might even be able to have intellectual conversations about it without getting too upset. But the last couple of years, I've definitely heard people just having such strong polar opinions that they'll just quietly disown their friends. Sometimes they do have a confrontation. Other times they don't. They just stop talking to them. They'll just stop following them on social media whenever they see them posting about a political view. And then they just completely stop calling the person. So I think that it has gotten to that point. And I will say that it's because most of the times when people have political views, it feels so inherent to a value system of theirs, right? And Tommy, you and I have talked about values before and how important that is to you and me and to everyone. It's like this idea of like, you know, what are you about? That's really the fundamental idea of what values are. And so when someone's values are seemingly so different from yours and people really attach their values to their political beliefs, it's like, okay, well, this is an impasse. We're never going to get past it. And I just don't even like you as a person. I don't even think you're a good person. And so they start to then attribute other negative qualities when the values don't line up.
What would you say to somebody who is hesitant to make that first micro connection or to try to develop a real friend, that person that doesn't want any friends, afraid to make eye contact? I can't believe that that's the quote normal human condition. I got to believe we're all social animals, right?
Right, definitely. And I would say that, you know, for everybody, their comfort level is different, their bandwidth is different, what they respond to is different, right? Some people don't need to talk to somebody to feel connected. They just need to be sitting next to somebody or doing something that is of interest to both of them, but kind of in parallel as opposed to, you know, being interacting directly with one another. They just need to be around the presence of people without necessarily having to engage. I know people who say, you know, if I just go to the local coffee shop and work from there for a couple of hours in the afternoon, I don't have to even talk to anybody about anything there. But as long as I'm kind of around people, that kind of recharges me. I believe that that's true because, again, we're built in a way, Tommy, that we're designed for safety in numbers. So in general, you'll find that our stress levels and our cortisol, et cetera, will decrease when we're around others as a general rule than if you're just completely by yourself. And again, that's evolutionary. It's like our species are meant to survive with other people around us because there truly is a type of safety in numbers. And so a lot of people will just say, I feel calmer when there's a few people around, but I don't have to be talking to them to get that benefit. And I think that that's an okay way to start as well if social anxiety is something that's an issue for you. You know, you don't necessarily have to make conversation everywhere you go. That's not really realistic.
One thing I did bring up with my friend, and we were talking about how much we value the relationship with each other, is that I said, now what I think we should do to cement it is buy a boat together, jokingly, because that's one way to just destroy a friendship. Are there any general rules when it comes to friendships, money, hitting them up for charity causes, et cetera?
Yeah, well, I think that it's okay to do anything that you feel the most comfortable with, as well as, you know, discussing this with your friend. I don't know about general rules, but I would caution that financial matters really tend to tear people apart. And people will say, sure, no, don't worry, you're on hard times, you want to borrow a few thousand dollars, just take it. I don't even want to have anything written with you that like describes what the terms are. You need to get them in writing. You know, even with a friend, that will cause a lot of resentment if things change and shift later and there's nothing in writing. So it's much better that you just say, yeah, I know you're saying that now, but I'm going to write this down right now that I will be returning this to you in 6 months in full. Okay. Like I'm going to write this on a piece of paper. It doesn't have to be a contract. You have to go to a lawyer, but it really needs to be agreed upon beforehand. That will help solve a lot of problems. If you are going to get in kind of any kind of financial investments, borrowing money, anything like that, just make sure you have something in writing.
Well, this friend, I was under some pressure to raise some funds and he owns a business. So I hit him up for a $500 donation, which I felt bad about, but then he hit me up for a $500 donation for his organization. So I figured, okay, we're even. That's fine.
Yeah, you guys are square.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think that's, it's also okay to, again, this is about value systems again, right? When you're trying to raise money for a foundation, it's something that's important to you. And a good friend, even if they don't donate that time, hopefully they don't feel offended that you asked, because in a way, it's kind of you just sharing something that's deeply important to you with a person you trust. And obviously, if you're going to do that, you can always just say, hey, it's no pressure, but this organization and what they do means a lot to me. It'd be great if you could, you know, contribute. But if not, please, no hard feelings. Mm-hmm. I've just been asking a few people about this because this is a really important cause for me. I think that if you frame it in that way, they'll probably be okay with it. And in your case, Tommy, it's clearly square because you both donated to each other's important organizations.
I hate to ask people for money. I would rather pay it myself. I swear to goodness. Thank you, Dr. Judy. A pleasure. You too? You and I are the same person. Yeah. You know that.
I'm sure you remember in childhood, you know, when you were trying to raise money and I would just have my parents, please, can you just buy
a
few?
Same thing. Same thing. My parents would buy it. They said, we don't want you going door to door. We'll just buy it. Thank you, Dr. Judy. A pleasure as always. I think you and I are kindred spirits separated by a nation. Thank you.
Yes, for sure.
Have a good day. All right.
Have a good one.
You too. We'll take a break. Come back. Find out what Newell's got planned for us today here on WWL.
Your true crime podcast keeps listeners on the edge of their seats. But here's the real mystery. Why isn't it making more money? Odyssey Creator Lab is here to solve that. We host your show for free. No fees, no catch. You focus on the suspense while our sales team brings in advertisers and revenue. Stop leaving money on the table. Apply now at creators.odyssey.com and turn your passion for true crime into real revenue.